Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves, presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute. It's time to begin.
Good evening. On behalf of the Tattered Cover Bookstore, it is my pleasure to welcome you and to thank you for supporting your local independently owned bookstore, because without your support, we simply would not exist. Allegra Houston's memoir, Love Child, is a deeply moving story of a girl's coming of age, coming to terms with the surprising turn of events in her life, and how she came to follow her own path to a writing career, family life, and independence. It's also a tribute to her parents, family, and the luminous circle of friends, acquaintances, lovers, and artistic colleagues who were part of the family. As a starred reviewed in Publishers Weekly reads, where many memoirists compete to see who's had the most outrageous life, this story stands out in its quiet poignancy and great sensitivity. We are delighted that Allegra Houston is with us tonight to share her story. Would you please join me in making Allegra feel welcome?
Thank you. Thank you all very, very much for coming out. I appreciate it. It may seem a bit presumptuous to write a memoir when, you know, why should anyone really be that interested in my life? I'd just like to start off by talking about why I wrote it, why I think anyone should be interested, what I think might resonate with people. And it's not the sort of movie star element of it and the famous names, but the fact that I come from a family that was atomized when my mother was killed in a car crash when I was four. After that, I was introduced to a man, led into a hotel room by a woman I hadn't met before, and told, "This is your father." And I thought there was something a little fishy about it at the time, or in the years afterwards, you know, as you would. You're not usually introduced to your father. You know your father. And then it turned out, when I was 12, my stepmother sat me down and said, "Actually, that isn't your father. Your father is somebody else, and he's coming to visit tomorrow." So it was a very fractured family. It was a family that was, you know, at the center of it, or at the center of my life, was this secret. The fact that I was a love child, that my mother and my father were both married when I was born. They just weren't married to each other. Mom had left Dad, John Houston, my father, who I grew up calling Dad and always was and is Dad to me, couple of years before I was born. He had actually gone off and had a child with another woman, my brother Danny. John Julius, my real father, was married to his first wife, Anne, and had two children, my brother Jason and my sister Artemis. There was a kind of musical chairs that went on at one point, and a bunch of people got divorced and remarried, and he's now married to his second wife, Molly, who I adore. So yes, I'm a love child. We decided at a certain point that basically we should take the line of we're out and we're proud. I wrote the book because I actually do believe in that. I think that there are a lot of families that are torn apart by secrets, that are fractured or fragmented by fate, by whatever happens. And that it really is worth living by the dictum that my dad lived by, which was, rise above it, honey. To rise above all the histories and resentments and secrets, and love the family that you have, whatever shape it is. So that's really why I wrote the book, and what I hope in my story will resonate with people who, you know, don't really give a damn about me. So I'd like to read you a couple of bits from it. The first passage I want to read is not exactly the one that I just described of being led into the hotel room to meet my father, but probably the second time I met him. After my mother was dead, I lived for 6 months in the house of my godfather in London, and then he couldn't keep me anymore, and I moved to Ireland to my dad's estate. There were two houses there. There was the big house, which was his house, and the little house where I lived with Nurse, who was my Irish nanny. And when I first got there, he was away, because he was away most of the time making movies. So this is a passage that describes his first return to the big house after I'd moved there. Betty, who appears in this piece, is Betty O'Kelly. She was the estate manager. I was standing next to Betty as she made herself a drink in the hall of the big house. The smooth marble top of the desk that served as a bar was level with my chin. The footwell was filled with bottles, colorful labels with bright liquids inside. Betty's black cigarette holder, its gold tip stained with lipstick, rested on a glass ashtray. Betty ran her fingers along the dark wood where it came out past the marble. "When your father comes home, he'll be this color," she said. "Mahogany. He's been in Mexico." When the day came, she lined us up on the front steps of the big house. Mr. and Mrs. Cray, that was the cook and the butler, and their daughter Karen, the maids Mary and Mary Margaret in their pink uniforms, Jackie and Caroline Lynch, their father was the groom and they were my age, and me. Betty stood on the top step beside the open door, faithful subjects forming a processional route to welcome the king home. I was nervous. I was Mr. Houston's daughter now, in second position next to Betty, but I felt like a fraud. I barely knew him. Should I run to him the way daughters did in books? It didn't feel right, and I didn't think I ought to break up the ceremonial symmetry. But what if he expected me to, and I didn't? It seemed like we waited on the steps for hours until wheels scrunched on the gravel. The car, with Patty Lynch driving, came around the side of the house and drew to a halt, perfectly centered between the stone lions at the foot of the steps. The passenger door opened. Long legs unfolded themselves. I saw the same soft, chestnut-colored shoes. Like a jointed puppet, Daddy stood up, far taller than I remembered him. I felt scared suddenly of this looming stranger. But Betty was wrong. He wasn't as dark as the wood of the bar. He greeted everyone individually as he came up the steps, a nod or a shake of the head, shake of the hand to one side and then the other. My greeting was no different, just, "Hello, Allegra," before Betty ushered him inside. She beckoned to me, so I followed. He went straight into the study while Betty fixed him a drink. I hung around her. "Go into your father," she said. He asked me questions, and I answered in monosyllables, shy and uncertain. Yes, I was happy in the little house. Yes, Nurse was well. Yes, school was fine. Yes, Jackie and Caroline and Karen were my friends. "Very good, honey," he said. The words, like everything he said, came out slowly and deliberately, as if he'd thought them over carefully before speaking them. So, I lived in Ireland at St. Clarence for 3 years. And then he sold St. Clarence. He couldn't really afford to keep it up anymore. He was away the whole time making movies in order to pay for it, because, as you can see, it was a very upstairs, downstairs sort of place with what my sister Artemis calls hot and cold running servants. It's a good phrase, isn't it? So then I lived for a year in Long Island with my grandparents, my mother's parents. And that was really when I came to know my sister. After Mum died, she kind of disappeared from my life. She's 13 years older than I am, Angelica. My brother Tony is a year older than her. And they had been sat beside me in this very carefully choreographed scene when I was told that my mother was dead and I would never see her again. She had been driving to Italy, to her father's house, when she was killed in the car crash. And I never really questioned why Angelica didn't come to Ireland to visit Dad. I know, you know, the reason now. She had made a film with him, and it was not a happy experience for her. And so they were kind of a bit estranged for a while. But when I met her, she was modeling in New York. It was really like meeting her for the first time. And then we both fetched up in L.A. a year later. And so I'm going to read you a little bit about that time in L.A. Best of all was when Angelica would pick me up, and we'd drive along beautiful San Vicente Boulevard, its wide grassy median lined with gnarled red-barked coral trees, toward Hollywood, where she was sharing a house with her old friend from London, Jeremy Railton. She had just got her driver's license, and she joked about how hard it had been for Jeremy when he taught her to drive to keep her under 60 miles an hour. The radio was always on. When Bob Dylan came on singing Knocking on Heaven's Door, Angel turned up the volume and sang along. That was how I wanted to be, carefree, knowledgeable about music, in control of the wheel, speeding ahead. I sang too, grateful to Dylan for writing a chorus that was the same line repeated four times over. The sameness of the boulevard, the sameness of the song. If only this sunlit cocoon of a drive could never end. Angel told me about the first time she had met Gladys. Gladys was my dad's secretary. It was Christmas time, and Gladys came to St. Clarence without any presents for Angelica and Tony. "I don't give presents to people I don't know," Gladys had told them. "I will give you presents when I know you better." "Can you believe it?" said Angel as we drove. She looked over at me, smiling. She didn't even need to keep her eyes on the road. "Outrageous!" I hated her instantly. She was laughing at her greedy 8-year-old self, but some of the outrage had stuck. I would have too. It was a lie. I didn't want to admit that I wouldn't have expected a present, or if I had, I would have quickly and silently revised my incorrect views. I wished I had Angelica's sense of entitlement. It seemed to sum up everything that made her more interesting, more confident, more truly special than I was. It really wasn't actually very easy growing up as the younger sister of one of the most beautiful women in the world, who was not only beautiful but also intelligent and charming and funny and can sing and can draw and is artistic and everything else. So, you know, some of the book is also about that relationship, about finding my identity in the family of stars when I really wasn't a star. I wasn't... you know, tall and long-limbed and beautiful, and I never felt that I fit in that world. And Angelica's world was a very glamorous one. She was going out with Jack Nicholson at the time, and I used to spend weekends at his house. His daughter Jennifer is a year older than me, and we were best friends, and so we would spend the weekends playing with each other for years. Then after that, Angelica left Jack and fell in love with Ryan O'Neill and would take me to spend time there. And my stepmother, Cece, with whom I was living, thought this was an extremely unsuitable place for a 13-year-old. Ryan O'Neill didn't hide his cocaine use or anything else, and, you know, Tatum would be dressed up in absurdly adult clothes and taken to parties, and Cece thought this was very bad. She and Angel had a fight about it, and the result was that actually I ended up living with Angel full-time, which meant I lived with her and Ryan for 6 months until she finally left him. I took credit for being the one to tell her to do it. I'm not going to read you that bit of the book, although I do tell that story in it, but I'm going to read you a little bit about Jack's house. Jack's bedroom, I'll just give you a little quick précis of the house to begin with. He still lives in the same house, and it's not a grand kind of movie star house at all. It's just sort of perfectly ordinary wooden ranch house, you know, kind of, I think, 3 or 4 bedrooms. 2 of them are upstairs, and his bedroom overlooked the pool at the back. It's not a particularly big house at all. Jack's bedroom upstairs had a little balcony overlooking the pool. Often Jen and I would be swimming when Jack made his first appearance of the morning, folding back the hinged balcony railing, taking a running leap, and cannonballing into the pool with a wild whoop. It's true. Bozo, his black Labrador, would leap in after him, crazy with excitement, his nails clawing as he dog paddled close to us. I shrank away from him, fearing the red welts Bozo's nails raised on my arms. "Grab him," Jack urged me. "Dance with the big bow." Jack's ability to play awed me. He didn't play like a child. He played like an adult who knew how to have fun, like Jack. A bit wild, but always in control, abandoned to the moment for just as long as the moment lasted, and no more. He seemed to know exactly what he wanted to do at any given second. He spent long hours upstairs in his room reading, history and philosophy mostly, names like Hegel and Nietzsche that I'd heard of but hadn't imagined anyone actually reading. He collected paintings to the point of obsession, and he was as delighted at discovering a new painter he admired, or a lesser-known painter such as Alma Tadema or Bouguereau, as he was at acquiring a new Picasso or a Dufy. I was there when a moving truck arrived with a giant canvas of a woman smoking a cigarette by an artist I hadn't heard of named Tamara de Lempicka. There was only one wall big enough to hold it, the one opposite the stairs. Though the overall effect was cosmopolitan rather than mythical, I saw in the woman's faceted face and angled body echoes of Dad's St. George. Dad was a painter, too. Pulling out of the reading here. He loved painting, and I loved to sit in his studio in St. Clarence and watch him paint. Jack bought so many paintings that they soon overflowed the wall space and had to be stacked against the walls of the Garfunkel suite, as the maid's room was known. Eventually, the room was so full of stored paintings that there was no room for Arthur Garfunkel to stay in it anymore. Jack's pals came over to watch the Lakers road games. I didn't really like basketball, but I liked watching it with Jack. On the screen, fuzzy, washed-out giants in yellow uniforms pounded up and down a court while Jack yelled at them, jumping up and down like them, cheering as loud as if he were in the stadium. His pals pounded the air and cheered, too. A little less loudly, a little more decorously, like backup singers. It reminded me of Dad, another king, another court. When I decided to write this book, it grew out of an article that I wrote for Harper's Bazaar magazine in the UK about my two fathers, because I'd woken up one morning. I'd been writing magazine articles, and I was always trying to think of, you know, more subjects that I could pitch to editors. And one morning I woke up and thought, you know, this is an article I really want to write about how lucky I feel to have these two fathers. I didn't always feel lucky. When I was first introduced to my real father when I was 12, it did not come as good news. I felt very much that I was losing a father, that I was losing Dad rather than gaining a father. But curiously, it didn't change my relationship with Dad in the slightest, not even infinitesimally. We only grew closer and closer until he died. And then parallel to that, I very, very slowly developed a relationship with my real father, to whom I'm very close now. Some people here have even actually danced with him. And when I told him that I was going to write this book, he was very, very supportive, 100% enthusiastic that I should do it. And he sent me to his safe deposit box at a bank in London to get the letters that my mother had written to him. They were apart a lot, so in those days that necessitated letters. And this young man, very sort of important heir, came and gave me these two manila envelopes tied together with string and sealed with red sealing wax. And it was over a year before I dared to open them. I knew I would have to if I was going to write this book, and that was kind of the whole point of it. But I was, you know, I knew it was going to be a really emotionally wrenching experience. So I waited until I kind of wrote everything else I could first, and then I kind of, you know, had to open them. But part of the story of this book also is the search for my mother. One of the real... There are different losses when you lose a parent that young. You've lost your parent, you've lost the mothering that she might have given you, but you've also lost the opportunity to know her. I was very envious of my sister's friends who knew my mother better than I did. I always felt that was very unfair. So part of the process of writing this book was the process of finding her and coming to know her as a person and not just this sort of unicorn, this perfect creature of extraordinary beauty that everyone adored, all of which she was, but, finding the humanity in that. I very much felt in her place as I read the letters that had been written to her that she kept. And then the only ones that I had that she had written were the ones that she wrote to my father. So I'm going to read you a little section about the experience of reading those letters of hers and a little bit about what I discovered about their the beginning of their love affair. I found myself reluctant to break the seal and open those manila envelopes. "You were a child of love," Cece had told me. But in reading the letters Mum had kept and her scraps of diary, I'd seen her in love with other men and not Dad. The struggling young man, the Argentinian diplomat, the writer-adventurer Patrick Lee Fermor. I was glad that she had found happiness in those romances until they curdled. But I wanted my father to be different, to be the man she loved above all others. I thought he was. Because of all those men that she fell in love with as an adult, he was the one whose child she had kept, had felt kicking her as she looked out her bedroom window to the house where he lived with his wife and children across the canal. Reading her letters to him was the promise of pain. I dreaded it. I tried to put them into date order without opening them, according to the postmarks on the envelopes. Many were missing or too smudged to read. I could order them roughly by the address on the envelope, only one to his house, the others care of the Foreign Office where he worked, or to his club, or to a hotel in Geneva, these last with her handwriting disguised so that it wouldn't be obvious that a member of the British delegation to the Nuclear Disarmament Conference was being deluged with love letters. But to reconstruct properly the shape of the love that had created me, I would have to unfold each one. The first letter was dated October 1961, nearly 3 years before I was born. The last was written in January 1969, the month Mum died. I corralled my eyes within the top inch of the top page of each letter, but always words leaped up from below like fish rising. "Dearest," again and again. Most of the letters were 6, 8, 10 pages long. Some were written only a day apart, some only hours. Heartbreak lapped at me. The movements of my hands became detached and robotic as I folded each letter again and put it back in its envelope, marked the date on the outside, and slotted it into place in the torrent. On my own sofa, surrounded by the physical manifestation of the love that brought me to life, I was surrounded also by Mum's death. I would not be reading these letters now if she had lived to see me grow up and bounce her grandson on her knee. And I knew so much more than she did. I knew how this overwhelming, mind-consuming passion, with so much absence in it that demanded letters, would end. Mum met John Julius at a house party in the early autumn of 1961. By the time of the first letter, October, passion has flooded her. She yearns for his body, his mind, his generous self. She loses herself in the blue crystals of his eyes. I am happy for her delirium of passion, and for the fact that the person who aroused it in her was my father. But my emotions are wrenched by the intensity of the life force flooding through the ink of her pen, a life force that only a few years later will be extinguished in the split second of a car jouncing into a pothole and up into the path of an oncoming truck. I put the letters down, unable to bear it. And the second I stop reading, I have to start again, as if the sorrow of reading them were heroin. She's electrically attuned to the currents of the weather, the tiniest fluctuations of the light, the breaths of wind that stir leaves and grass and brush her skin, the shadings of the clouds, the scents of flowers and rain. I can follow the wave lines of her moods, the joy of John Julius's love soaking into her pores and shimmering from her, the sadness she attempted to conceal and overcome, the shadow of iron circumstances from which she bravely turns her face away. Thank you very much for coming out.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we've been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. visit www.belco.org/authors.asp for your chance to win a $200 tattered cover gift certificate and learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.